This episode is made possible by Awin. Two-thirds of digital ad spend currently flows to the three big tech platforms, Google, Meta, and Amazon. But their auction-based ad models favor their own bottom line and inflate costs at a time when every single marketing dollar counts. Awin's affiliate partnerships platform offers a real alternative to big tech and puts you back in control of your ad spend. Want to find out how? Visit awin.com/emarketer to learn more. Hello, everyone, and thanks for hanging out with us for the Behind the Numbers Weekly Listen, an eMarketer podcast made possible by Awin. This is the Friday show that is trying out a new voice. Right, Susie?
That's me. Yep.
Didn't you say you wanted to, you were like, I'm going to try a new voice for this episode.
I wanted to try a new character voice.
Susie was like, I want something a little bit more
deep,
husky.
Hey.
That's how you described it.
I just said I was sick. Are you sure you want me on the show?
It's got that gravel to it.
Amazing. You're like, obviously I want you to come back.
Oh, I didn't realize. You didn't say you were sick. You said you were trying out a new voice for no reason.
Okay, whatever. Luckily it's in Marcus writing.
I'm your host, Marcus Johnson, in today's show. Will people eventually buy items in shows?
How bad does the show have to be for you to hit pause to buy something and not wait till the end of the show, the way you might if you're watching it on Disney or Netflix?
Are online ratings broken?
And I think like any other piece of data, if you don't use it in the right context, it's useless. But when used in the right way, it's very important.
Can a relaunched Amazon shipping compete with FedEx and UPS?
We've been seeing, you know, initiative after initiative that Amazon has come out with over, you know, the last couple of years to really take control of the fulfillment and delivery ecosystem.
Can news and sports move the needle for Max? Target expands its Starbucks partnership to grow curbside pickup. And where did gas stations come from? Join me in this episode. We have three people. Let's meet them. We start with our senior analyst covering everything retail based out of New York City. It's Blake Droesch.
Hello, everyone.
Hey, chap. We're also joined by the vice president of content who heads up the retail team based out of New York as well. It's Susie David Kenyon.
Hey, everyone.
Hey, Susie. And finally, we have our principal analyst who heads up our digital advertising and media desk based out of New York, just above the city. It's Paul Werner.
Great to be here as always.
Hello. So what do you have in store for you? We have a story of the week, we play a game, and then we end with some trivia. Let's just get to it. We start, of course, with the story of the week. Will people eventually buy items in shows? A recent Economist article notes that Citadel, a thriller on Amazon Prime Video, shows what happens when the world's biggest online retailer, Amazon, becomes one of the biggest entertainment producers, as the article explains. As bullets fly around a high-speed train carrying a former Miss World and a gang of spies through the Italian Alps, shopping is surely the last thing on viewers' minds. Yet should they press pause on the show, they will see an option to buy items from the show. The heroine's gold necklace, her red dress, or the teetering stilettos in which she is improbably running rings around the villains. And so this is from that Economist article, basically offering up the question of whether people will eventually buy items in shows. What do we think, folks?
Well, this is not a new concept. I mean, Disney and Netflix have done it very well in the streaming world. And what Amazon has going for them, of course, is they have this infrastructure, this retail infrastructure in place. So anything that is featured on one of their shows or movies is naturally going to drive people to buy it right on Amazon if they choose to. So, you know, I think they have an advantage here. But as far as the concept itself, I mean, it's probably as old as entertainment.
You mean shopping is?
Well, I mean,
I'm just
interesting.
Joking.
I mean, getting people interested in buying things they see in shows or movies. I mean, everything from.
It's like sponsored marketing, kind of, right?
But, yeah. And I mean, if you think about all the product placement that's happening now on pretty much everywhere, it's pervasive. I mean, I have a friend who is going to Sicily mostly because of White Lotus.
Yep. Marketer's dream.
So that's not a direct benefit to Netflix, which streams that show, but it certainly underscores just what people are willing to do when they're inspired by something they see on a screen.
I totally agree in that it's not new and that people you know, we are studying, Blake especially is studying, and we're trying to do a new forecast on shoppable media. It is very clear that there is a delineation between being inspired by a TV show and being able to purchase the things you see. But I do think it'll just depend on how intrusive it is and how easy it is. And I actually think Amazon has it maybe a little bit harder because there are more friction points, right? In this particular instance, there's only three items from what she's wearing that are up for grabs. But what if you want something else that's not there, and all of a sudden that causes some friction? Or what if there's something that's up for grabs that's part of the program, but then Amazon doesn't have the inventory to deliver to where you live? So I think there are going to be a lot of friction points before it becomes truly natural. But as Paul said, there are many other ways that it's happening. Whether it's Netflix, Macy's tried this reality show with a couple of other retailers where fashion designers showcase their work, and then lo and behold, whatever they wanted to buy on the show made it into the store. Not as successful because I think they just didn't iron out the kinks, but that's probably the most important part. It's how do you make it easy?
But there's no... So people may be inspired by what they see in shows and then go buy it, whether that is direct product placement or whether that kind of accidentally happens because of a location that's featured in the show or otherwise. But there's no direct kind of click through onto that item and into a store, correct? If someone presses pause, for example.
Like that hasn't existed before?
No, I'm saying, well, Paul, you were saying about Netflix and Disney already kind of being involved in this, but that we don't have a bunch of people sat on their couches at home who are pausing something, seeing that they can... Oh, there's that like LeBron James jersey because I'm watching a Lakers game and it shows me that I can buy that jersey through the TV, and I press on it and I go through to the NBA store and I buy it through the television. That's not happening.
Not that I know of, but right. I have a feeling that with Amazon, especially if they're doing this in a thriller type show, I mean, how bad does the show have to be for you to hit pause to buy something and not wait till the end of the show the way you might if you're watching it on Disney or Netflix? So,
right.
Yeah. I mean, the goal with any type of shoppable media is, you know, the dream is that it sort of, you know, flattens the marketing funnel to, you know, from discovery to purchase. But that's, you know, as you pointed out, that's not really the way, you know, people shop. The advantage for Amazon is basically to use their website and the data that they gather, because they know what you're watching and they know how you shop, to sort of to link the two to hopefully, you know, create some resonance with products that they may be seen on the show. But even, you know, I think with the type of products that are being talked about in this example, it's probably things like apparel that require some more decision making. But even with some of the consumer studies that I've done in the grocery and CPG space, where you have products that are lower cost and are probably, you know, way more conducive to impulse buying, people are still not really, you know, enacting this type of behavior in terms of like shoppable recipes and things like that. So it seems to me like an even further stretch that there's going to be, you know, impulse shopping for accessories and apparel from television shows in the way that Amazon, you know, seems to maybe, you know, be positioning it in like an ideal scenario.
But I wonder if that's also because we're just not conditioned to do it yet, right? And what, like to Paul's point, nobody's pausing a TV show without realizing they're going to do that to make a purchase of a dress. But if we start thinking about it kind of like live streaming, where it's not really, we're not doing it yet, but we think that there is potential for certain product categories and for certain use cases, maybe there is for this too, although probably a thriller is not the right show.
Yeah, like when I watch Citadel, I'm definitely going to buy those stilettos, but I'm just not going to do it in the moment.
I do think that there is no data play here either, personally, but I do. The article keeps going on about Prime might start introducing advertising. And there I see the closed loop where Amazon knows what you're already buying. Mm-hmm. And so if you're on Prime, they'll try and convince their advertisers that they understand who the audience is and will service me, for example, Oreo cookies, and Blake, Chips Ahoy.
Yeah, I mean, well, they already do that with their free ad-supported streaming service. Used to be, is it called Freevee now?
Yes.
It used to be IMDb TV. But the problem is that, you know, it doesn't attract a ton of eyeballs because the content isn't really that good. And I think that's what this all comes back to, is that if Amazon's going to try and work this model, then, you know, content becomes king. It's not necessarily as much about the data and the connectivity between the media and the storefront. But if people aren't watching the shows, then nobody's going to be interested in buying the products.
Yeah. And, you know, Amazon now has a huge audience with Thursday Night Football, to which, of course, they serve ads as well. So right. they can connect a lot of those dots.
That's mm-hmm. the thing. I really do think it's for the NFL that even the distinction between Coors and Miller or other brands that you prefer, if they start to see what your activity is, then you're much more engaged if they service that to you. And they can convince an advertiser that their platform is worth more money because they know exactly who the audience is and what they're buying.
Mm-hmm. Right. So if I'm watching Thursday Night Football in a few weeks and I want to buy an Aaron Rodgers jersey, oh, wait, no.
Yeah,
so,
you're out of luck. Yeah. Oh, yeah, you'll have a better chance of buying a...
soon.
I didn't
Jets
get
fans.
That one.
I'm sorry. You know what we're talking about, right, Susie? You get
no
it.
No idea.
Of course.
You'll have a better chance, Blake, of buying a jelly-filled Twinkie.
I was at the game, though, so I will say that I did witness the final moments of Aaron Rodgers' career with the Jets.
Brutal. A lot of this discussion is around watching shows on a TV, on a CTV. A lot of streaming does happen on the computer, so maybe people will be more likely to click through to an item if they can use their mouse. Maybe CTVs could use a mouse. Easier to navigate around than using the controller.
But, I mean, at the end of the day, if it's not easy and the viewer doesn't realize that they're also being treated as a consumer, then it's not going to mm-hmm. work. It doesn't matter what the platform is.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe you don't want to then and there buy the product, but maybe being able to just throw it into your cart for later to have a look at it, revisit it, is the play. All right, folks, that's what we've got time for the story of the week. We've got to move on to the game of the week. Today's game, What's the Point? I read out four stories and Susie, Blake and Paul would give us their main takeaway of the story. Okay answers get 1 point, good answers get 2, and answers that give you the same feeling as zero balance on your credit card, a feeling that no one has ever experienced. Answers that leave you with that feeling, they get you 3 points. Each person gets 20 seconds to answer before they hear this, the bell. If you run long, it's -2 points. Whoever has the most points wins, gets the last word. Let's do it. We start with Paul. For round one, are online ratings broken? Questions Ian Bogost of The Atlantic. He thinks the root of the problem is that a request for your feedback is actually a means to accrue data. E.g., the demand to know if you'd recommend us to a friend indicates the pursuit of a net promoter score. A doctor who asks for a rating is likely just trying to raise their local search engine rankings so new patients can find their practice, Mr. Bogost writes. But Paul, are online ratings broken? What's the point?
They've been broken for a very long time because they now are at a point where every single thing you do generates a survey, and it's just gotten to where I will stop answering, or I'll give negative reviews just because I'm annoyed at getting a survey.
Susie.
So I have such a different perspective. I think this article was absurd, the way he talked about ratings. I definitely agree that we're being bombarded by requests at every part of the journey, and that's wrong, and that a brand should work together across all the different parts of the operation and send one survey towards the end of the experience. I think having obviously positive reviews helps increase conversion. So it's really important. And I think like any other piece of data, if you don't use it in the right context, it's useless. But when used in the right way, it's very important. So I really, really, really believe in these. And I think everybody should be doing them. And you should only be doing them because you believe in whatever you're giving them, not because you're annoyed.
Blake.
Yeah, I think that from a lot of the data that I look at, ratings and reviews are still extremely influential. I mean, it's basically the first thing that most consumers do after the awareness stage, when they, you know, become aware of a product or begin a journey. So figuring out a way to, I think, legitimize the public end of rating and reviews is going to be very important going forward to sort of maintain the consumer confidence in it, which is going to have to mean that people are going to have to trust, you know, what's happening on the back end as well. And, you know, this is a little bit beside the point, but, you know, I wonder, you know, how much harder it's going to be to sort of verify and legitimize these types of reviews once, you know, brands and, you know, small businesses can start using AI to sort of generate a lot of, you know, potentially fraudulent feedback. So I do think it is something that you're going to be hearing a lot more of, just the verification and the ways that ratings and reviews and surveys are conducted in the coming years.
Can I just add one thing? Sorry. sorry.
Please.
I do think it's really important that if you are taking the time to ask your consumer whether they made a purchase or not, because sometimes you get a survey for not making a purchase, that you use the data, right? So that you understand if the bathroom wasn't clean and there were a lot of thumbs down, that you do something about it, right? And so if you're asking for it, then use the data to make a difference in your business.
Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm.
That's a good point. Blake, to your point about reviews being important still very significant, a PwC study showing that customer reviews are a slightly wider used research tool before a purchase than speaking to other people or using social media. However, most folks still use search engines, go to Amazon or head directly to the retailer's website to do product research. However, there was one example of a company just packing in when it comes to reviews. Insider Intelligence Retail Briefings analyst Rachel Wolf was pointing out that e-commerce marketplace Zalando will no longer show customer reviews or give shoppers the option to leave one. Why? Number one, because so few people leave reviews on its site. A single bad one could have an outsized impact on the brand's sales and reputation. And number two, it frees the company up from the headache of having to police fake and misleading reviews. Round two, we start with Susie. Can a relaunched Amazon shipping compete with FedEx and UPS? Amazon has resurrected its ground shipping service that it paused back in 2020 due to the pandemic. As our retail analyst Zach Stambaugh explains, Amazon sellers can now use Amazon shipping, even if they are shipping from their own warehouses. It can also handle delivery for products sold on other marketplaces like eBay or sellers' own websites. But Susie, Amazon relaunching Amazon shipping, what's the point?
I think the point is that it's not so much that can they compete with UPS and FedEx as much as Amazon is always trying to figure out a way to integrate all of their different business units to maintain its brand identity, especially when it comes to fast shipping and to be able to create new revenue streams, right? So they paused it because it wasn't working really well for them for whatever reason. There are many and the list is too long to go over, but they've realized that now that everything has settled back and there isn't this influx of online shipping, that they need to figure out how to recreate that sticky ecosystem to get people to keep coming back to them and to continue to make more money.
Blake.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, if you own all of this entire fulfillment network, then, you know, why not use it? And we've been seeing, you know, initiative after initiative that Amazon has come out with over, you know, the last couple of years to really take control of the fulfillment and delivery ecosystem, not only for brands that are on their website and selling on their website, but for, you know, other retailers with Ship with Prime and a bunch of other sort of adjacent programs. But really what this is about is, you know, creating a business presence in so many different places and over time attracting more sellers into its network so it can have more control of the data and then eventually, you know, greater market share in these different categories. And Amazon has done so well with large brands that, you know, the future is really going after, you know, these different pockets where they might be underpenetrated. And I think this is part of their long game.
Paul.
Can I just ask for a clarification before I answer? So This article by Zach said that Amazon had paused the program in 2020. So what are all the Amazon trucks that I see every single day and have seen, if not Amazon shipping?
So that's Amazon shipping is different than Amazon logistics.
Uh-huh.
Amazon logistics is basically them delivering packages that are bought on their marketplace. Amazon shipping is specifically for packages that are not being delivered from an Amazon warehouse.
Okay.
That was a great question.
So I guess my takeaway here is that I would assume that part of the calculation for Amazon is saving money on their FedEx and UPS contracts, which, you know, I would assume also that they're going to continue those contracts, but maybe are able to downscale them. In terms of the infrastructure and extending this service to all Amazon sellers on the network, that makes a lot of sense to me. So I agree with Blake on that. It just seems that this is another case where, you know, the rich get richer, where Amazon has deployed this massive shipping and logistics infrastructure. And why not continue along that path and make even more of it?
Mm.
All right, at the halfway mark, Paul is ahead with 4 points. Susie and Blake in joint second with 3 apiece. We start with Blake for round 3. Can news, CNN, in this instance, and sports move the needle for streaming service Max? Well, 2 pieces of news here. Number one, Isabella Simonetti and Joe Flynn to the Wall Street Journal recently wrote that Warner Brothers Discovery, WBD for short, is adding a CNN-branded live news service for its Max platform that will carry original programming and content from CNN's cable channel. CNN Max, as it's called, will be available to US Max subscribers from the end of September at no additional cost. Second piece of news here is that Max will reportedly start offering free sports later this year for a few months, writes Emma Roth of The Verge. She notes that using this promo, WBD hopes to attract more viewers by showing live NBA, MLB, and NHL games. But Blake, can news and sports move the needle for Max? What's the point?
Well, it's complicated. I guess we'll start with the news first. I think the news, no. We've already seen what a colossal disaster CNN's previous premium streaming service, I think, was it Plus? It wasn't CNN.
CNN Plus,
which lasted for like, you know, 48 hours, one news cycle. So that, no. I mean, younger folks are not typically watching CNN at the rate that, you know, older people are watching cable news, and they're still on cable. Sports, perhaps. However, you know, when I hear about some games across different leagues, as, you know, a sports fan, that's very annoying to me. That doesn't create a good experience if I'm someone who watches the NBA, but I have to jump from platform to platform. So yes, if I already subscribe to the service, sure, it's great to have an extra game. But if I'm a super fan, I'm probably already getting access. And if I don't, it's annoying to have to go. So maybe good for Max in general, but not good for the sports organizations to keep, you know, fracturing up the viewership.
Paul, on the news part of it, the fact that they're launching another over-the-top news service around CNN is living proof that the original debacle with CNN Plus was purely political, because really they're coming back and doing the same thing. Though I will say one key difference is this is free, whereas the other one, they were actually going to charge a subscription for CNN Plus. So there's that. There's also the fact that CNN is a very well-established news brand. So to the extent that you're going to try to serve news to people, you might as well do it with that brand. And we all know that this company has definitely had problems with branding. On the sports front, I agree with Blake. I also think that if you offer sports as a freebie, it's only going to lead to at some point charging and charging more. So it kind of sets people up for a bad user experience, but I think it's kind of a moot point because, again, to Blake's point, most people who are subscribing to sports are doing it because they are super fans, and you know, giving someone like a 1 month or 3 month trial doesn't really serve that audience. Mm.
Susie.
So I agree with everything. The question was phrased in an interesting way for me, because it's like, who is this servicing? Is it CNN and the sports people, or is it Max, right? Because I think they each have different things to gain. CNN is looking for a younger audience. They clearly couldn't figure it out on themselves, whether it was paid or not paid. I think this lends itself well to getting a whole new audience that they don't typically get. But to Blake's point, does that younger audience actually tune in? So just by being part of Max, does that mean people will be watching CNN? Probably not. And then this, I don't know enough about sports, so I didn't even think about how you're splintering the audience. What I was thinking more along the lines of was like, it's trickery to give me something for free and then have me pay for it. And if you only have some of the different leagues, but not NFL, which I thought was the most popular sport in the US, then does that make me want to buy Max more? Probably not. Mm.
Yeah, I think the difference between the two is important. CNN Max versus CNN Plus, which is now shut down. As we mentioned, CNN Plus used to cost $6 a month, and it didn't have CNN's highest profile content. So it had some kind of tangentially related shows, kind of like ESPN Plus. It wasn't ESPN, the main channel. It was some shows that were kind of sports content surrounding the main channel. So the hope is that giving folks the real kind of highest profile CNN content and giving it to them for free will make a difference. And they say in this article saying that they're trying to combat a multi-year rating slump starting to hit the bottom line. So they're looking to do something to change that. Let's move to round 4. Double points round 4. Paul still ahead with 6. Susie and Blake just behind on 5. We start with Paul for round 4. Target. is expanding its Starbucks partnership to grow curbside pickup orders, writes our very own Rachel Wolf. She notes that the expansion to over 1,700 stores will be completed by October. But Paul, Target expanding its Starbucks partnership to grow curbside pickup orders, what's the point?
Well, they need all the help they can get, Target, and Starbucks is definitely a magnet. What I'm wondering is why this is just about curbside pickup and not Starbucks in Target stores, because that seems to be a very effective partnership as well. I mean, you know, selfishly, I use it a lot because I know Starbucks always has the best Wi-Fi. So if I need to use Wi-Fi, I might go into a Target store knowing they have a Starbucks, and I might be more inclined to make a Target purchase.
Susie.
So I agree. There's no point in that. I think that curbside pickup is a service that every retailer should be offering. If you're trying to differentiate yourself by having Starbucks available at the car, that's amazing. But I don't understand the stat around how 20% more bigger baskets, because you're not going to buy more at curbside pickup just because there's Starbucks, right? I think to Paul's point, having the Starbucks in the store, which I think a lot of them have it, and you do store pickup is excellent, right? Because then all of a sudden you're going to maybe potentially buy other things. So unless the Starbucks curbside increases frequency of making random purchases at Target, I don't think there's a point.
Blake.
Yeah, I agree. And obviously, you know, Target is very proud of this idea. They seem to really love, you know, toting this example. And it is a good idea, but I will just, you know, caveat that our forecast shows curbside pickup users basically plateauing from here on out. That market's kind of maxed out, but in-store pickup users are set to increase. And as Susie mentioned, it's always more advantageous to get customers in the store, and that future, you know, partnerships and other marketing collaboration should really be centered around the in-store pickup offering, not so much curbside.
Mm. Great points, folks. Yeah, Blake, to your numbers about curbside being flat, 72 million folks in the States doing curbside and then going into the store to pick up stuff is still inching up. That's at 94 million, so higher than curbside. More folks likely to do that than curbside. But Target, yeah, they're trying to boost online shopping growth. We estimate Target's e-commerce sales will grow only 3% this year versus Walmart's 13%. And last year, Target's online shopping was an even lower 1.4%. Currently, of Target's online orders, about 40% are click and collect. But that share is flat, has been for a couple of years. All right, folks, at the end of a hideously low-scoring game of the week, we'll take a drum roll.
It was pretty solid all around.
It was pretty poor.
That's so rude. And we got -2.
8 points for Paul, 7-7 for Susie and Blake. So Paul wins.
Wow.
Congratulations to Paul.
It's kind of a backhanded compliment. You won, but everybody sucked. You just sucked a little bit less.
It wasn't your best performance, people. So that's just what the numbers say.
That's
8 points. That's just how that's just what the numbers say, you know?
The arbitrary, super subjective numbers.
It's official. The official numbers. Paul, congratulations.
Congratulations.
You didn't need to do much to beat Susie and Blake this week, but you did. You did enough. 8 points.
I don't like to overexert myself.
The last word.
The last word. Wow. Okay.
Actually, this score's pretty low. Maybe it's not really deserving of a last word. Let's just move on. Move past it.
You make the rules, Marcus. Last words if you still want to hear them, but
yeah, go on. Just a few words, just half of
a few words about pips. And if you're wondering what the heck I'm talking about, I can't blame you. But do yourself a favor and Google Gladys Knight and the Pips, specifically their signature hit Midnight Train to Georgia. And what you'll hear if you listen to that song is that her backing band and backup singers, who are of course the Pips, they're back there like egging her on and repeating and amplifying what she's saying. Sometimes they're anticipating her, like maybe like a high school drama teacher who feeds a line to a kid on stage. And sometimes they're just like singing along in harmony. But the way they do it is always fun and pleasant and constructive and understated. So they're never trying to upstage her or contradict her. They're just backing her up and building her up. So I just want to make a nod to those particular Pips, but also to wish for all of us that we all have our own Pips. I think it would make the world a more beautiful and more harmonious place. So there, Pips.
Thank you. That really saved this segment, to be honest, because it was pretty awful up until that point. But nice, it was a nice sentiment, Paul. Well played.
Marcus Johnson and the Pips.
We ended strong here.
Marcus Johnson.
Anyway, that's what we've got time for the game of the week. It's time now for dinner party data. It's the part of the show where we tell you about the most interesting thing we've learned this week. We start with Paul, because he won. He only needed 8 points to do it, but he won nonetheless.
Well, what's the highest scoring game? Come on.
It's usually not about 8 points.
Not this one. No, there's strong double figures normally. Max gets comfortably into double figures. Blake, I think you've been there before.
Wait, what's the number? What's the highest value per question? 4 points?
So what's the highest value per question? You can get a total of 15. So 15. It's not.
Okay. I'm
pretty
sorry,
bad.
He got more than half.
Like yeah, he did. Eight. It's not Paul
see.
I'm talking about,
see.
Really.
No, was yes. there? Has there ever? What's the record? Like, I want to know, like, who's like, what was like the Kobe Bryant 81-point game?
Oh, you're asking for too much now.
Probably Mark Dolliver. Yeah.
Oh, Mark. Yeah, Mark. That man put up numbers.
Yeah, yeah
he did.
I don't even know who that is.
Mark. He's only in the Hall of Fame. Famer. Head to Canton, Ohio. You'll see him in the Hall of Fame.
The Black Mamba of the Weekly List.
Wow.
I still think we should have him back on the show one of these days.
Yeah, we should. Mark, we miss you. All right, Paul, you're up.
So dinner party data. So this is in honor of International Women's Day, which is today. It's officially March 8th, but I always say when it comes around every year that every day should be International Women's Day. So that's today. And this is a not a very encouraging report from the World Economic Forum about the Gender Gap Index, which measures gender parity across economics, politics, health, and education. So this report noted that at the rate of change that the world is going through, it will take 131 years for the world to close that gender gap. And it ranks countries.
Have that long. We definitely don't have that long. Yeah.
We don't have that long. No, it should happen today on International Women's Day. But it also ranks countries by where they are. Iceland has closed 91% of the gender gap, while Afghanistan has closed just 40% of it. It's worth noting that, Marcus, the UK is ranked 15, which is not great. But, I mean, sometimes, as we know, you can win without scoring a lot of points. U.S. is ranked 43rd. And Saudi Arabia, 131st. So there's obviously a very big gap. But bottom line is everybody should just get their act together and work toward gender parity today, not in 100-something years.
Mm-hmm.
Just saying.
Be nice to not have to bring these numbers up at all, because there wouldn't be anything to talk about. But unfortunately, there is, Paul, very good numbers to kick us off. Susie, you're up next.
Well, mine's not quite that meaningful, because I wanted to talk to you all about happy hour.
Here we go. Okay.
Yeah. Every day is happy hour as well, Susie. So
my dad is visiting, and one of the things we do when he comes is go and do oyster happy hour. So I wanted to find out more about happy hour and the term. So do you all know how it started?
Enlighten us. I have no idea. You know, Marcus?
Oh, Marcus, do you know?
No, I'm kidding.
It starts around 2 o'clock every day, right?
Yeah. That too.
Good God.
Yeah.
Okay. We'll talk after this show, Blake.
1913, 14, depending on who you follow. The U.S. Navy, it started with the U.S. Navy. They used to do weekly entertainment programs to alleviate boredom with live music and dancing and movies and other things. It didn't include alcohol. Alcohol started during the Prohibition in the 20s and 30s, where Americans had to get together at speakeasies or people's houses to drink before they went out to dinner because they couldn't drink at dinner. So they had a cocktail hour before going out. And so it became a euphemism for a secret and festive hour. Today, it's what we do as a collective, where you get a good deal. In the 1960s, they started doing discounts on food and drink as a way to lure people into restaurants. However, because of binge drinking, did you know that there are certain states in the U.S. that have prohibited happy hour?
I didn't know that.
Massachusetts.
Correct. One of the first, Massachusetts, implemented a ban in 1984. Alcohol has to be the same price throughout the day, because they don't want it to be a bad influence.
Mm. Thanks, Boston.
Yeah, yeah.
I feel like Blake's got something to do with that, given the earlier comments.
Hey, hey. I've only been there a few times.
The good news about happy hours is that according to restaurant Tally Group, it increases the number of transactions during happy hours by 24%. And according to YouGov, slightly dated research, so I'm sure the numbers are even higher now, it's 45% of people who attend an office happy hour do so to get to know their colleagues better, and they believe that it increases their happiness by 66%. So go to happy hour, but don't binge drink.
I'll raise a glass to that.
Blake, you're up.
So last week, the Rolling Stones announced the upcoming release of their 26th American studio album, which is coming out on October 20th. It's called Hackney Diamonds. And when the album comes out, Mick Jagger will be 80 years old and Keith Richards will be 79 years old. So I did a little bit of poking around to see who the oldest touring musician from that era was. So obviously there are some of them, a lot of them actually are still around. Not all of them are still putting out albums. Not all of them are still touring, but there are obviously some big names that are still out there on the circuit. So one of which obviously is Bob Dylan. Bob Dylan's currently on the Never Ending Tour, which is going from, I think, 2021 to 2024. He's 82 years old, but older than Bob Dylan is the blues guitarist. So more of an influence on sort of that crop, the Rolling Stones and Bob Dylan, but Buddy Guy, blues guitarist, who's 87 years old and is still touring. The oldest musician that I found, a popular musician that is still touring, is Willie Nelson, who's currently 90 years old and is still out there doing it. So it's good to know that, you know, if you're Mick Jagger and Keith Richards, that they, you know, maybe still got another decade of touring in front of them.
That's a lot. I'm just trying to get to 50, you know?
I remember that this gives you an idea how old I am, but the first time I saw the Rolling Stones was on the Steel Wheels tour in 1989. And the joke at the time was it was the Steel Wheelchairs tour. So that was, 34 years ago? And so, you know, here they are still doing it. And yeah,
I think they let you into the show. You were a toddler.
I had a fake ID.
Paul.
Got it.
Yep.
This changes everything.
Take the belt away.
And thank you, Susie.
Unbelievable.
All right, folks, got one for you real quick. Where gas stations came from. So there are 145,000 gas stations in America, according to the National Association of Convenience Stores. There were about 200,000 in the mid-90s, so there are less today. In the days of motoring before dedicated gas stations, motorists bought gasoline from hardware stores, general stores, pharmacies, etc. That's because these businesses already had relationships with the refineries through their sale of kerosene used for stoves and as a lighting fuel. The fuel was poured into the car's gas tank using a funnel. Due to rather obvious fire danger, gas started to get sold at filling stations, according to the 1994 book The Gas Station in America by John Jackall and Keith Skull. Where and when the first gasoline station appeared is difficult to establish, since various types of stations appeared on the American scene between 1907 and 1913, they write. And so in 1905, the first dedicated gas station is established in St. Louis, according to one source, St. Louis, Missouri, at 420 South Teresa Avenue. In 1907, 2 years later, the first service station is established, or was installed by Standard Oil of California, it's now Chevron, in Seattle, Washington, what is now Pier 32. A service station is different in that it's a gas station, but it also offers other services, oil changes, repairs, stuff like that. So gas station, 1905, service station, 1907. But the oldest existing gas station in the US, still going today, is Reinhard's gas station in Altoona, Pennsylvania, just 2 hours east of Pittsburgh, established in 1909, and it's still there.
Who knew?
4.8 stars on Google.
So were those authentic reviews, or
yeah,
have they been verified?
They've been verified.
I thought the Corn Palace place, or Nawal Drug, or whatever that place is in the middle of America, was the oldest pre-gas station, sort of place where the horses came to get fed and watered and whatever else, rested.
Is this a real place?
The horses actually went there for happy hour.
This a real thing, Susie, or like when you made up Crater Moon?
I didn't make up Crater Moon. That's a real thing.
Okay, sure.
It's in the Dakotas. No, it's truly a real thing. The wall drug thing is also real. It's like the gigantic drugstore in the middle of the country. I'm going to Google it and send it to you.
Okay. But there is, speaking of giant establishments in the middle of the country, this past summer, Buc-ee's opened the world's largest gas station in Sevierville, Tennessee. 74,000 square foot location with 120 gas pumps that employs over 350 people. America, what are we doing? How stressful? Isn't it stressful enough going to a gas station?
It is. More than six pumps, it just, it's just too much.
It's chaos. 120.
I wonder what they'll do when all the cars are electric.
Well, that's interesting you bring that up, Susie, because when Marcus set up this segment, I thought he was going to maybe talk about, like, I know he introduced it as where did gas stations come from, but I read an article recently about what is going to happen, and it turns out it's really hard to decommission a gas station because they have a lot of underground storage tanks that you can't just shut them down. So not exactly like shutting down a nuclear power plant, but there's a lot of aspects to it that have to be considered where you just can't, you know, convert a gas station to an electric recharge station or even anything else. So I think we're going to have to reckon with that somehow over time.
Yeah.
As more electric cars hit the roads.
Because you do see a lot of them, don't you? You do see a lot of them like decommissioned, but they're still there and you wonder why they haven't been cleared away.
Yeah.
So that's a really interesting point, Paul. That's what we've got time for today's episode. Thank you so much to my guests. Thank you to Susie.
Thanks for having me.
Feel better. Thank you to Blake.
Thanks again.
And thank you to Paul, this week's winner of the Game of the Week.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you, of course, to Victoria, who edits the show, James, who copy edits it, and Stuart, who runs the team. Thanks to everyone for listening in. You can head to behindthenumbers_podcast at Instagram if you want. You don't have to. We'll see you guys Monday, hopefully, for Behind the Numbers Daily, a new marketing podcast made possible by Awin. Happy weekends.